In the beginning of 1920, I put forward the idea of holding our first mass meeting. On this proposal, there were differences of opinion amongst us. Some leading members of our party thought that the time was not ripe for such a meeting, and that the result might be detrimental. The press of the left had begun to take notice of us, and we were lucky enough in being able gradually to arouse their wrath. We had begun to appear at other meetings, and to ask questions or contradict the speakers, with the natural result that we were shouted down forthwith. But still we thereby gained some of our ends. People began to know of our existence, and the better they understood us, the stronger became their aversion and their enmity. Therefore we might expect that a large contingent from our friends from the Red Camp would attend our first mass meeting. I fully realized that our meeting would probably be broken up, but we had to face the fight, if not now, then some months later. Since the first day of our foundation, we were resolved to secure the future of the movement by fighting our way forward in a spirit of blind faith and ruthless determination. I was well acquainted with the mentality of those who belonged to the Red Camp, and I knew quite well that if we opposed them tooth and nail, not only would we make an impression on them, but that we might even win new followers for ourselves. Therefore, I felt that we must decide on a policy of active opposition. Herr Harrer was then the chairman of our party. He did not see eye to eye with me as to the opportune time for our first mass meeting. Accordingly, he felt himself obliged to resign from the leadership of the movement as an upright and honest man. Herr Anton Drexler took his place. I kept the work of organizing the propaganda in my own hands, and I listened to no compromise in carrying it out. We decided, on February the 24th, 1920, as the date for our first great popular meeting to be held under the aegis of this movement, which was hitherto unknown. I made all the preparatory arrangements personally. They did not take very long. The whole apparatus of our organization was set in motion for the purpose of being able to secure a rapid decision as to our policy. Within 24 hours we had to decide on the attitude we should take in regard to the questions of the day which would be put forward at the mass meeting. The notices which advertised the meeting had to bring these points before the public. In this direction, we were forced to depend on the use of posters and leaflets, the contents of which and the manner in which they were displayed were decided upon in accordance with the principles which I have already laid down in dealing with propaganda in general. They were produced in a form which would appeal to the crowd. They concentrated on a few points which were repeated again and again. The text was concise and definite, an absolutely dogmatic form of expression being used. We distributed these posters and leaflets with a dogged energy, and then we patiently waited for the effect they would produce. For our principal colour, we chose red, as it has an exciting effect on the eye, and was therefore calculated to arouse the attention of our opponents and irritate them. Thus they would have to take notice of us, whether they liked it or not, and would not forget us. One result of our tactics was to show up clearly the close political fraternization that existed also here in Bavaria, between the Marxists and the Centre Party. The political party that held power in Bavaria which was the Bavarian People's Party, affiliated with the Centre Party, did its best to counteract the effect which our placards were having on the red masses. Thus they made a definite step to fetter our activities. If the police could find no other grounds for prohibiting our placards, then they might claim that we were disturbing the traffic in the streets. And thus the so-called German National People's Party calmed the anxieties of their red allies by completely prohibiting those placards which proclaimed a message that was bringing back to the bosom of their own people hundreds of thousands of workers who had been misled by international agitators and incensed against their own nation. These placards bear witness to the bitterness of the struggle in which this young movement was then engaged. Future generations will find in these placards a documentary proof of our determination and the justice of our own cause. And these placards will also prove how the so-called national officials took arbitrary action to strangle a movement that did not please them, because it was nationalizing the broad masses of the people and winning them back to their own racial stock. These placards will also help to refute the theory that there was then a national government in Bavaria, and they will afford documentary confirmation of the fact that if Bavaria remained nationally minded during the years 1919, 1920, 21, 22, and 23, this was not due to a national government, but it was because the national spirit gradually gained a deeper hold on the people, and the government was forced to follow public feeling. The government authorities themselves did everything in their power to hamper this process of recovery and make it impossible. But in this connection, two officials must be mentioned as outstanding exceptions. Ernst Pirner was chief of police at the time. He had a loyal counsellor, Dr. Frick, who was his chief executive official. These were the only men among the higher officials who had the courage to place the interests of their country before their own interests in holding on to their jobs. Of those in responsible positions, Ernst Pirner was the only one who did not pay court to the mob, but felt that his duty was towards the nation as such, and was ready to risk and sacrifice everything, even his personal livelihood, to help in the restoration of the German people, whom he dearly loved. For that reason, he was a bitter thorn in the side of the venal group of government officials. It was not the interests of the nation or the necessity of a national revival that inspired or directed their conduct. They simply truckled to the wishes of the government so as to secure their daily bread for themselves. But they had no thought whatsoever for the national welfare that had been entrusted to their care. Above all, Pirner was one of those people who, in contradistinction to the majority of our so-called defenders of the authority of the state, did not fear to incur the enmity of the traitors to the country and the nation, but rather courted it as a mark of honour and honesty. For such men, the hatred of the Jews and Marxists, and the lies and calumnies they spread, were their only source of happiness in the midst of the national misery. Pirner was a man of granite loyalty. He was like one of the ascetic characters of the classical era, and was at the same time that kind of straightforward German to whom the saying, "better dead than a slave," is not an empty phrase, but a veritable heart's cry. In my opinion, he and his collaborator, Dr. Frick, are the only men holding positions then in Bavaria who have the right to be considered as having taken an active part in the creation of a national Bavaria. Before holding our first great mass meeting, it was necessary not only to have our propaganda material ready, but also to have the main items of our program printed. In the second volume of this book, I shall give a detailed account of the guiding principles which we then followed in drawing up our program. Here, I will only say that the program was arranged not merely to set forth the form and content of the young movement, but also with an eye to making it understood among the broad masses. The so-called intellectual circles made jokes and sneered at it, and then tried to criticize it. But the effect of our program proved that the ideas which we then held were right. During those years, I saw dozens of new movements arise and disappear without leaving a trace behind. Only one movement has survived. It is the National Socialist German Labour Party. Today, I am more convinced than ever before that though they may combat us and try to paralyze our movement, and though pettifogging party ministers may forbid us the right of free speech, they cannot prevent the triumph of our ideas. When the present system of statal administration and even the names of the political parties that represent it will be forgotten, the programmatic basis of the National Socialist Movement will supply the groundwork on which the future state will be built. The meetings which we held before January 1920 had enabled us to collect the financial means that were necessary to have our first pamphlets and posters and programs printed. I shall bring the first part of this book to a close by referring to our first great mass meeting, because that meeting marked the occasion on which our framework as a small party had to be broken up, and we started to become the most powerful factor of this epoch in the influence we exercised on public opinion. At that time, my chief anxiety was that we might not fill the hall, and that we might have to face empty benches. I myself was firmly convinced that if only the people would come, this day would turn out a great success for the young movement. That was my feeling as I waited impatiently for the hour to come. It had been announced that the meeting would begin at 7:30. A quarter of an hour before the opening time, I walked through the chief hall of the Hofbrauhaus on the Platz in Munich, and my heart was nearly bursting with joy. The great hall, for at that time it seemed very big to me, was filled to overflowing. Nearly 2,000 people were present. And, above all, those people had come whom we had always wished to reach. More than half the audience consisted of persons who seemed to be communists or independents. Our first great demonstration was destined, in their view, to come to an abrupt end. But things happened otherwise. When the first speaker had finished, I got up to speak. After a few minutes, I was met with a hailstorm of interruptions, and violent encounters broke out in the body of the hall. A handful of my loyal war comrades, and some other followers, grappled with the disturbers and restored order in a little while. I was able to continue my speech. After half an hour, the applause began to drown the interruptions and the hootings. Then interruptions gradually ceased, and applause took their place. When I finally came to explain the 25 points and laid them point after point before the masses gathered there and asked them to pass their own judgment on each point, one point after another was accepted with increasing enthusiasm. When the last point was reached, I had before me a hall full of people united by a new conviction, a new faith, and a new will. Nearly 4 hours had passed when the hall began to clear. As the masses streamed towards the exits, crammed shoulder to shoulder, shoving and pushing, I knew that a movement was now set afoot among the German people which would never pass into oblivion. A fire was enkindled, from whose glowing heat the sword would be fashioned which would restore freedom to the German Siegfried, and bring back life to the German nation. Beside the revival which I then foresaw, I also felt that the goddess of vengeance was now getting ready to redress the treason of the 9th of November 1918. The hall was emptied. The movement was on the march. The end.